This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1954, Roger Bannister achieved the unthinkable, becoming the first person to break the four-minute mile barrier. Bannister's record-breaking run redefined the human capacity for endurance and speed, and it remains one of the most significant moments in sports history. More than 60 years later, we may be on the verge of the next major milestone in long-distance running, the sub-2-hour marathon. And it may happen as early as 2019 if the scientist Yiannis Pitsilatis has his way. New York Times sports reporter Jeri Longman spent 7 months following him on his quest to break the 2-hour barrier, from mountain villages in Ethiopia, across Europe, and to the Dead Sea. And Jeri, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So the world record for the marathon is 2 hours, 2 minutes, 57 seconds. Is running a marathon in under 2 hours such a big leap?
Yes. So it's essentially 6/10 of a mile, so more than half a mile. So that's a big leap from where we are now. You have to make up nearly 3 minutes.
Well, so one person who is working on this is Yiannis Pitsilatis. His approach to breaking the 2-hour barrier bucks conventional wisdom for elite marathon training anyway. So help me unpack it a little. When it comes to training, marathoners consider mileage and altitude and diet and time of day one runs. What is Yiannis's plan?
Well, his plan is to challenge the convention. He's got it this consortium of scientists together that will, you know, as you just said, from areas of nutrition to training to biomechanics, he's challenging the dogma of distance running. So, for instance, many elite marathon runners will run 120 miles a week, but Yiannis Pitsilatis says there's no science behind that. It's just sort of tradition and consensus. He's challenging even, you know, should you even drink during a race? We're always told to keep hydrated during a race, but his theory is that maybe in the second half of the race, as you burn fuel and sweat and become lighter, it requires less energy to maintain a certain speed. So maybe you shouldn't drink in the second part of a race.
Another one, live high, train low. He's suggesting live high, train higher.
Right. So live high, train low is essentially familiar training for elite distance runners. And that what it basically means is, so you live at a high altitude to enhance production of red blood cells and thus your oxygen-carrying capacity. But to train low means you train low at near sea level so you can have intense workouts. And he's spent a lot of time around Ethiopian runners who live at very high altitude and train even higher than that. So his theory is, well, maybe we need to live high, train higher, which may stimulate even, you know, the growth of even more red blood cells and sort of trick your brain in a way. These sort of hypoxic workouts at extreme, you know, 13,000 feet or whatever, your brain becomes so accustomed to that that when you get to sea level, it's just like, you know, it's like having had weights on your feet and then you take the weights off and theoretically you could run faster.
He's also pushing the limits of how technology might be able to improve running performance way beyond the heart rate monitor. So what are some of his more kind of out there ideas?
Well, some of them are just basic ideas. I mean, one thing I didn't realize is that we know almost everything about the biomechanics of sprinting. We know their feet lands at a certain way, that their heel goes down for 1/12 of a second and comes back up. But we know almost nothing about what's the optimal form for distance running. So they're starting with that sort of basic question. Is there an optimal form that would reduce fatigue or energy costs? And then from that, he wants to explore things like using genetic technology. For instance, if certain genes are expressed at a certain level or altitude or a certain level of exercise and it's producing red blood cells, maybe you can keep him within that zone and enhance his oxygen carrying capacity in a legal way.
Part of his quest is actually finding a kind of ideal for a runner who can break the 2-hour barrier. So what is his prototype?
Well, his theory is that the person who will break the 2-hour barrier is someone we don't know, probably a teenager now living in a highland village in Ethiopia or Kenya, someone that spends a lot of time, you know, walking or running to school, herding cattle, hauling water, that has a very active lifestyle. He's done a study where he studied Kenyan children, and they showed that they had 170 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous exercise compared to 20 to 40 minutes a day for European children.
So it's not just genetics, but a culture and how
Yeah.
someone is accustomed to living.
So So, yeah, I mean, he believes in the primacy of genes in determining athletic ability. So he likes to say in his speeches, you know, choose your parents well. But he actually believes that what really determines the dominance of Kenyans and Ethiopians in running is cultural and socioeconomic factors, because they are living a pastoral lifestyle. They're always in action. As I said, the kids are averaging almost 3 hours a day of moderate to vigorous activity, which is far more than in Western countries.
So he's actively seeking this out. And you actually followed him to Ethiopia, where he worked with, for instance, a 14-year-old runner, hooked him up to a mask, testing his oxygen levels. He later told you the kid wouldn't be the first to break the 2-hour barrier for marathoning. I felt like the kid was, you know, an imperfect specimen, and then next on to the next one. How did you feel witnessing this?
Well, we were in a village called Bakoji, Ethiopia, which is a highland village, farming village, wheat and barley, and it's at altitude. But it's a village of 17,000 people, and it's produced 10 Olympic gold medals. So Professor Pitsilatis thought it would be the perfect place to begin looking for the 2-hour marathon runner, and it seemed a logical place. But once we got there, he pointed out, oh, these kids, they're wearing shoes. And one of the Ethiopian experts, the altitude experts that was with us, said, and this seems counterintuitive, but because they're building more schools in the countryside in Ethiopia, while it will help their education system, it may hurt them as runners because they're not running as far to school. So Professor Pitsilatis said, basically, you know, these have become city kids, so maybe we're 20 years too late. So maybe he would have to go to a higher, more remote place to find his athlete. I mean, he believes that the person who will run under 2 hours will be a barefoot runner. And when you run barefoot, you're carrying less weight on your feet, so there's less energy cost. And also, when you run on your barefoot, you tend to strike in your forefoot or your midfoot. Therefore, you can run on the hardest surfaces comfortably. So he believes that these runners could run on asphalt if they had to that far. An Ethiopian won the 1960 Olympic marathon in Rome running barefoot.
So he wished he'd gotten here sooner, before development. He's mapping the human genome, determining physical capacity. Isn't there a whiff here of the Westerner picking from the locals to find his ideal runner?
Well, he would disagree with that. I mean, he is sensitive, I think, to trying to impose his thinking on East African nations that have, you know, been winning Olympic gold medals for half a century. So he got, you know, ethical permission from Addis Ababa University in the Ethiopian capital, which is where he's a visiting professor. And we went to the school, and he sat down with the principal and the vice principal and the renowned coach there and explained what his program was, explained that it was not simply Westerners who were, you know, wanted to employ this program. And the coach and the principal were right away just said, yeah, sure, we'd like to do this because it will help us take trial and error out of our identification of young athletes. That the more science we have, the better we are. And actually, maybe much of what Professor Pitsilatis is doing is, because doping is so widespread, he's trying to use science to overcome doping, to try to basically say, I can make you run faster using legitimate science than you can on banned drugs.
Mm-hmm. And he's on the IOC's anti-doping committee, isn't he?
Yes, he's on the International Olympic Committee's Medical and Science Committee, and he's at the forefront of developing the next drug test for EPO, which is a blood-boosting drug that's widely used in distance running to increase your oxygen capacity.
To return to Bakoji, this Ethiopian town where Yanis Pitsilatis was doing a lot of his research, he's talking about science. He's talking about technique. And there, they seem to get that pretty well. Technique, certainly. They know their bodies. How about their religious beliefs that sometimes ran absolutely contrary to science? Did you talk with him about that?
So there are, at least among the, not in Bakoji itself, but in Addis Ababa, where the world's best runners, the elite runners live. They tend to congregate in the capital. One of the pilot, the test cases for this 2-hour marathon is Kenenisa Bekele, who's a 3-time Olympic champion on the track, the world record holder at 5,000 and 10,000 meters, and is widely considered one of the two greatest distance runners in history. So for a while, he would not let one of the physiotherapists employed by the sub-2-hour project work on his legs. And the thinking was that maybe the physiotherapist was bringing bad energy from other runners into his own legs. This is associated with his beliefs in these spiritualists in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, known as Debteras, and they're complicated figures that are known as sort of healers, but also that can bring ill health on someone. So there is a belief among some runners their competitors could put hexes on them, or somehow these spirits can affect their performance in a bad way. So Professor Pritzalat has had to work through this with the runner to say, take control of your own destiny, that your success will depend on your training and your health, not on whether a priest is putting a hex on you.
Mm. Jerry, you're a longtime runner and sports reporter. Do you think that push, the better, stronger, faster, got to get under 2 hours, does that rob any of the joy out of marathoning?
No, because we've always pushed to go faster. I don't think it robs really any of the joy. I mean, if you have problems with doping, then maybe you're concerned about whether an attempt to go under 2 hours would just encourage doping. But I actually happen to believe doping should be legal, so I don't have a problem with that. But no, I mean, that's the way we are. I mean, look at the 4-minute mile. We keep pressing and pushing to go faster in the mile. And now there have been 11 U.S. high school kids who've gone under 4 minutes, including like 5 or 6 in the last few years, I think. So that's our nature, is to go faster, farther, higher. There are no scientists that I interviewed that think that sub-2-hour marathon won't happen. It's just a matter of when. I mean, some people think it won't happen until the 2040s. But Professor Pitsilatis thinks that if he can get $30 million from sponsors, he's about $29 million short right now. But he thinks that if he can get funding for all these scientists and these who have expertise in various areas, that he can get it done very quickly. And some people think that it could be done today just with better drafting techniques and pacing techniques. Or if you just put $5 million up to all the fastest guys and said, go for it.
Well, Jerry Longman, thank you for speaking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Jerry Longman, sports reporter for the New York Times. You'll find a link to his 2-part profile of Yiannis Pitsilatis on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.